Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, your designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. I think we have a heck of a program for you tonight, punctuated by a collection of butt-kicking bumper songs as we glide through the evening, a smattering of odds and ends on the website, and a lineup of two ridiculously interesting guests, each of whom I think will leave our brains buzzing. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, physicist, author, deep thinker, raconteur, Dr. Jack Sarfati will be here with us to talk about a little thing called reality and whether we're living in a computer-generated hologram. Also about stargates, wormholes, UFO propulsion, and a lot of other highbrow stuff that will clog your head for weeks, the physics of the paranormal, if you will. Jack is quite a character and a very smart man, and we're happy to finally have him back on the show. Later in hours 3 and 4 tonight, I'll be joined by Paul Stonehill, who might be the world's leading civilian authority on UFO cases from the former USSR. He was born behind the Iron Curtain, maintains great contacts and sources there, and has co-authored a new book that I think will be hugely important in this field. I am broadcasting to you tonight from inside the warm bosom of KXNT Radio, the number one talk radio station in Las Vegas, which has been kind enough in the past to sort of give me a home away from home and has extended that courtesy once again, for which I am certainly thankful. We asked if we could hang out in the KXNT studio tonight because the other location I used to broadcast from here in Las Vegas is still down. If you tuned in last month, as some of you know, listeners tuned in to hear this program about Sasquatch, but turns out Bigfoot was a no-show. We had some technical problems, and what happened was someone cut the phone line. It's actually called an ISDN line, which goes to this broadcast site I normally use. Took us a while to track down the problem, and no, it's not likely the men in black did it, more likely a construction crew or something like that. Thought we had the problem fixed. That is not the case, so I'm here at the radio station tonight and appreciate the hospitality, and engineer Fred Bennett is hanging out for the duration of the program, presumably so I don't mess things up or switch over to a porn channel or something like that. My coast-to-coast colleague, Ian Punnett, asked me to pass along a message to listeners about the reason his guest last night was a no-show. Walter Koenig, the actor who played Mr. Chekhov in that Star Trek series all those years, canceled at the last minute. But it turns out he has a very legitimate and troubling reason. You can read why on our coast-to-coast website. Walter's son is missing. Our webmaster, Tim Binal, has posted a news story about this disappearance. The son, who was also an actor, was last seen in Vancouver, been missing about a week. I think he was supposed to fly home to see his family and didn't show up. No one knows where he is, haven't heard from him. So, you know, everyone's worried, understandably. And the Coast to Coast family, including, I'm sure, our listeners, are sending positive vibes to Walter and his family. And we sure hope this has a happy ending. As we've all heard over and over and over ad nauseum this week, Tiger Woods held the big news conference this week, begged for forgiveness, groveled a little bit, then went back to rehab for sex addiction. You know, he says he's sorry. I'm the one who's sorry. I'm sorry. I simply don't care about this whatsoever. I don't care about Tiger Woods or that he cheated on his wife repeatedly. I don't care. This guy hits a ball with a stick for a living. He's very good at it, makes a lot of money. But it's still just a game, and I don't care. I can't help it. I'm not interested in reading about his sex life, vigorous as it obviously was. However, I recently found myself reporting about someone else's sex life, and it felt weird to do it, but there was a reason for it, other than prurient interest, that is. The person is the governor of Nevada. His name is Jim Gibbons. He's being sued in federal court for allegedly manhandling a cocktail waitress after a night of drinking a couple of years ago. He's also about to wrap up a nasty and prolonged divorce from his wife of 22 years, a divorce that our governor initiated on his own. So there have been depositions in both of these cases, and they've delved into some very naughty, salacious stuff. There is no question this has spilled over, I think, into the performance of Governor Gibbons' official duties. And in a way, it's affected the credibility of our state. The allegations that have been raised are pretty serious. So I felt that we, meaning the TV station I work for, we were justified in pursuing this story and obtained some explosive stuff. And lo and behold, the governor calls me up. He heard we were going to do the story. He left a message for me that he was going to sue the TV station and sue me personally if we aired this story. Now, it isn't every day that a governor of a state calls a reporter and warns him not to run his news story. Needless to say, we went forward anyway. If you're interested in seeing what it's all about, we have a link on the Coast to Coast website. Tim Banal, our webmaster, has helped me put together other stuff, an eclectic list of stuff, as always, including there's a video there of a drone that I think could cause a lot of mischief in the UFO world if it fell into the wrong hands. And just for the record, I'd like one for Christmas for next year in case you want to start saving for one. You'll see what I mean when you check out this video. A couple of stories that caught my eye and are posted there as well. One about the Mossad and its team of assassins, causing a lot of furor around the world. Another item about the CIA program behind the Glomar Explorer. Remember that? Howard Hughes cooperated in that one. And an item about James Cameron writing the prequel, not the sequel, the prequel to Avatar. Also there, an article about our own George Noory and the Coast to Coast Show. It's from the LA Times. And a shout out to our friends at the UFO Congress underway today in Laughlin, Nevada. I'm sure some of those folks are listening. Hope you're all having a good time down on the river. We have so much to cover tonight. I'm going to take this break now. And when we come back, Maverick physicist Jack Sarfati will be here to blow our minds. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. My name is George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Jack Sarfati graduated with a BA in physics from Cornell. He earned a PhD in physics from the University of California. He's had his fingers in all sorts of really interesting physics discussions and topics over the years. Has most recently been researching anti-gravity and dark energy. He's founded something called stardrive.org that we'll talk about tonight, has written several really interesting books that we'll also be getting into. But basically, we're here to talk with us about the physics of the paranormal. Jack, great to have you back.
Great to be back, George. And I hope his son is found. That was very disturbing, but, you know, best wishes for that.
Yeah, well, we'll certainly have an update if we get any news on that score during the program. Jack, I have this image of you that you're not exactly a typical physicist. I mean, you hang out with cafe society, you're friends with movie directors and showbiz types, you cruise around in a Jag, you got a lot of women photos with you.
Wait a minute, that was a long time ago.
I know of your life, it's a lot of women. Okay, I don't want to get you in trouble. But I mean, you know, right. I don't see any pictures of you in a lab coat with a calculator or spending time with test tubes or anything like that. Am I close to the mark?
I had the Pauli effect. Whenever I went near a lab at Cornell, the stuff would break at a distance. That's called the Pauli effect. And my one dalliance with experimental physics was when I ran the billion electron volt synchrotron at Cornell as a summer job. I was about 18 years old. And, we won't go into that. But,
but am I wrong to call you? Am I wrong to call you Maverick Rogue? Is that sort of that you kind of like that?
I'm a rogue scholar, yes. Definitely a rogue scholar.
Let's jump right into it. Yeah. I can remember as a kid having this idea that reality might not be real. I remember as a youngster, excuse me, having these feelings that, you know, some days just seem more real than others, meaning that some days were less real. And it was almost scripted, dreamlike. And I wonder if that is just a mental aberration or if there's something to it. And by that, I mean, walk us through this idea of yours that maybe all this around us is some sort of a holographic projection.
Yes. Well, actually, you know, it's not really, I mean, part of it, that the hologram may be in our future is my idea. That's my original idea. But that the idea that all the reality, that physical reality, is a kind of holographic image from a cosmic computer, that actually is not my idea. It's actually, I think it began with Gerard de Hooft, who is actually a very conservative, anti-paranormal, rigid physics professor in the Netherlands. And he sort of came out with this idea. And then Lenny Susskind, who Lenny and I were graduate students together at Cornell back, you know, in the early 60s, and he also came up with the idea. And it comes from black hole physics, actually. It comes from, and it's also connected with Hawking's the Hawking radiation from the surfaces of black holes. So the idea that we are kind of three-dimensional images being created by a kind of two-dimensional, you know, computer of some kind, that idea is kind of in the air. It's been in the air for, I don't know, maybe at least 10 years, maybe more than 10 years. And the thing is that the discovery of the dark energy about 10 years ago that's accelerating the rate of expansion of our space and our observable part of the universe, that kind of pins it down. It's almost the only way to understand that phenomenon is that we are a hologram. But what happened was about a year ago, I was preparing a paper, a written part of a paper from a talk I gave in Italy, in Tuscany, Italy, in Castiglioncello. And I was working with, I worked with a top NASA scientist named Creon Levitt, who's at NASA Ames, and Creon found this PhD dissertation by a young lady named Tamara Davis, who got a PhD about 2004 from the University of New South Wales. I guess that's in Australia or New Zealand, I'm not sure. But she published this thesis, which, by the way, she's gotten an award for it. And what she did was to take all the current, the best precision cosmology data that coming from all the experiments that we've been doing the last 10 years. And she plotted, like, the history of the universe from the moment of inflation to the hot Big Bang to into the far future. And what happens, because of the finite speed of light, our observable part of the universe is only a small piece of what you might call a multiverse. And it turns out that the hologram has to be in our future, you see, because it can't be in our past. It turns out that the numbers, what the physics shows us is that the dark energy density we measure is proportional to the 1 over the area of this future hologram. It's technically, it's called a horizon. It's called the future event horizon. And it turns out that the Earth, that everyone has their own future horizon. In a way, it's kind of like Leibniz's monads. But, of course, you know, your horizon, my horizon, you know, the universe is so big that we essentially have the same horizon. But it's a kind of a personal thing almost. And so the only way that the physics makes sense is for information to be radiated from our far future. And in such a way that we're actually being created from it as a kind of quantum computer simulation. See, that's kind of the idea. In other words, we are like three-dimensional holographic images of this two-dimensional computer, but this two-dimensional computer is in our far future. And, in fact, the way to think about it, you can visualize it, that there's a spherical surface, a wall of light, like a spherical wall of light. It's very, very far away from us, but the influence it has on us is coming from our future, and it actually corresponds to kind of metaphysical ideas of the Jesuit theologian Teilhard de Chardin, the so-called omega point theory. So these are, you know, now these ideas are not that well understood yet, and of course I could be wrong, but, you know, the only way to understand what we're seeing seems to be from this holographic theory. Now, you had apparently Sean Carroll was on Coast to Coast about a week or two ago. I guess he was with George Norrie. He wasn't with you, right, George?
No.
He was with George Norrie. And George, right. Sean Carroll is he's a young physicist, very smart kid. He's a professor at Caltech. And he has a new book, which is very good, called From Eternity to Here. You know, it's a play on the movie From Here to Eternity, right?
Right.
But
right.
Ask yourself, when is eternity? Well, when is this? When is eternity? See, I mean, it's not in our past, but we know from the Big Bang, our past, you know, time only started about 13.7 billion years ago. So eternity, it's not in our past. where is eternity? We always think eternity's got to be in our future. Now, I'm not sure that Sean was aware of the implications, kind of the Freudian subliminal implication of his choice of title, because, you know, things coming from the future, causes in the future influencing the past is not really kosher, you know, and most physicists, you know, will reject that as, you know, paranormal, you know, precognitive nonsense, something like that. I mean, there's a big bias against that. But it's curious that Sean, you know, chose that title, which implies kind of future to past. Okay, now there's another thing. What Carol spoke about on Coast to Coast was this mystery of the arrow of time. You know, why is it that time seems to flow in one direction when the laws of physics work equally well in either direction in time? And, you know, why is it that we age? And why is it that our aging is kind of coincident with the what's called the cosmological arrow of time, the fact that it's in the same direction, so to speak, as the expansion of space, that the universe is expanding in the same sense we are aging. As the universe gets bigger and bigger, we get older and older. And why is that? That's a mystery. In fact, if you read Stephen Hawking's popular books, he talks about that. And Hawking, in his early days, had an explanation. Then he said, oh, no, I'm wrong. Even the great Stephen Hawking, you know, great genius, says that I'm wrong. I made a mistake. It's this. It's not that. So physicists are very confused about it. But it turns out with the holographic theory, we can immediately understand both the arrow of time and why this cosmic anti-gravitational field energy, which is going to be relevant to the propulsion of UFOs, why it's so small. Okay, now let me just make a suggestion for those readers who are online, for all the wireless people online. If you are online and listening to the show, immediately go to your stardrive.org. Go to that website because there are pictures there which illustrate these are rather complex ideas. They're not easy.
Is this chart that you came up with?
Yeah, that's the chart. It's on. If you go to the blog, if you go to stardrive.org and you hit blog, and you have to go to page 2 of the blog, and there's an article there, is our universe a hologram? Okay? And it says, I have a funny quote, we all agree that your theory is crazy. The question that divides us is whether it is crazy enough to have a chance of being correct. And that's a remark of Niels Bohr, one of the great, you know, men of physics, the father of quantum theory, which he said to Wolfgang Pauli, who was another great, you know, physicist back about 100 years ago. And, you know, physicists like to joke, by the way. Physicists are always joking with, you know, at least at the highest levels. They have.
Oh, yeah, they're wacky. Yes,
yeah, oh, yeah,
physicists are wacky.
Definitely wacky.
Jack, now, you've mentioned now twice that, you know, physicists are still a little bit confused. They don't quite understand it. They're grappling with what this means. Well, you can imagine how the rest of us who are not physicists are having trouble getting our heads around the idea that everything around us is generated by a hologram that's, by a computer.
Absolutely.
In the future.
Now, the idea has been kind of popular. It has been in the New Age literature. David Bohm, who a man I studied, I worked with back at the University of London, quite a while ago, 30 years ago. Oh, my God, it's time flies. And the universe is getting bigger as time flies. But the thing is that he had this idea, the holographic theory of the universe, and he also worked with Carl Pribram, that the brain is like a hologram. So these ideas are floating around in a kind of general way, but they are not that precise. They're more, like a metaphor. But the theory, at least for cosmology, for physics, is now becoming very precise. And if you go to my blog there, if you go to StarDrive blog and you look at is the universe a hologram, you'll see this beautiful figure that comes from figure one. It's this colored figure, okay? And it comes from Tamara Davis's PhD thesis. And it kind of illustrates what I'm talking about. So those of you who are on your laptops, your computers, take a look at that and let it just sink in. And now here's the thing. With our new StarDrive site, George, we have the latest Facebook social networking Joomla dysfunction. We are really bells and whistles. Everything is going. I got all these brilliant these Joomla programmers sitting in the back room there. So what we're going to do, here's the idea of this thing. This is not just a place for people to go and get information. Of course, we want them to get the information, and we hope it's reliable information. In other words, we're going to try to vet things as much as possible so that you know when you read something on Star Drive, that at least from the physics, that it, you know, you can kind of believe it. You know, it should check out. And, you know, of course, we'll make mistakes, but, you know, we're going to check that. And the thing is this, but you can also, it's like Facebook, you can social network and you can contribute. You can contribute your own content. The site will be, moderated. You know,
meaning you're trying to make it a more highbrow and more selective in what it covers.
Yes, it's like this. You know, social networking is a big phenomenon now. It's changing the world, right? You know, look what Google's doing in China. You know, all this stuff. It's changing the face of civilization.
Hey, Jack, we need to take a break. That's okay. A song, by the way. We're playing bands from the Bay Area in your in honor of your appearance here. The Grateful Dead taking us into the break. We'll be back with more of Dr. Jack Sarfati. This is Coast to Coast, and I'm George Knapp. Stay with us. Our guest, Dr. Jack Sarfati, who just told us about the world as we know it may be not as real as we think it is. And if it's true that the world as we know it is a hologram generated by a computer in our future, the questions are obvious. Who and why? Is it a futuristic video game? Is it some sort of travel for futuristic, far-distant humans? I mean, the questions boggle the mind, and we'll jump into as many of them as we can get to when we come back. Right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Jack Sarfati about the physics of the paranormal, the multiverse, holograms. Jack, help me understand as a layman, as a non-scientist, what this concept means. I mean, am I real? If the world around us is a computer-generated hologram, am I real? Are you real? Do we have free will? Is it all programmed? Is everything scripted already?
Well, look, you're asking good questions. You all saw Avatar, right? Everybody's seen Avatar. Well, in this theory, we are the avatars. We are all avatars in a certain sense. We are being computed. We are being computed from a, from this future giant super, it's not a classical computer. It is a quantum computer. But it's even more than a quantum computer. It's what I call a post-quantum computer because it itself has consciousness. In other words, we're living, like Dean Radin has written a book, we're living in a conscious universe. And if you look at Stephen Hawking's first book, A Brief History of Time, the way he ends the book, and he has four questions about the mind of God. He asks about the mind of God. Well, in this holographic theory, the brain, now when I say the word brain, you could spell it either way. You could spell it B-R-A-I-N. Or you can spell it B-R-A-N-E, like in string theory, okay? I mean, a pun is intended there. It's deliberate ambiguity. But this wall of light, this spherical surface wall of light, which is itself the computer, is, you call it the brain of the mind of God. And the mind of God, in the sense of Teilhard de Chardin from the Vatican, you know, the Jesuit, are the computations. And then, you know, it says in the Bible that we are in the image of God, right? Well, that's exactly right. God is on this two-dimensional event horizon, in the sense of Einstein's general theory of relativity, and we are computed. We are its computed images. And the way it happens from the future is actually some pretty standard physics from 1940 by John Archibald Wheeler and Richard P. Feynman. So the Wheeler-Feynman theory, it was further developed by several people, by Sir Fred Hoyle, and by a student of his, Nalla Carr, and then a guy named John Kramer, the transactional interpretation quantum theory. So, you know, these ideas have been floating around. They're not like they're that new. But what has happened is that the discovery of dark energy, totally unexpected. Nobody expected there to be dark energy that was 70% of the stuff of the universe, plus, you know, the dark matter, which is 23%, so that ordinary atoms, the stuff we're made of, is less than actually 1%. The organized stuff, there's about 3% is like just clouds of gas and stuff like that. So this, you know, everybody's mind in science and physics and cosmology has been blown by these totally unexpected discoveries.
So it's a question of where is all this stuff? Where is it?
Oh, well, stuff, okay, now let's get into, you know, there's a big mystery, a lot of confusion about what is dark energy, what is dark matter. Well, you know, I have a very simple explanation for it in terms of conventional physics. It turns out, in the way I see it, I could be wrong, I could be maybe even not even wrong. It was even worse. But what I think it is very simple from just Heisenberg's uncertainty principle that dark energy are what are called virtual photons and other kinds of what are called bosons. I won't go into the distinction right now, but there are virtual photons and other things, virtual bosons inside the vacuum, the zero-point energy fluctuations of what are called spin one. That you can show through Einstein's theory of gravity that that will give you exactly what dark energy does. That gives you an anti-gravity field. Now, this is important if we want to float a UFO, right? This is important if we want to explain flying saucers, so that, you know, on a shorter scale. And it turns out dark matter is simply what are called virtual electron-positron pairs, or virtual fermion-antifermion pairs. And this is all pretty standard physics. And it turns out from the when you combine simple Heisenberg uncertainty principle quantum theory with Einstein's general relativity theory of gravity, it turns out that you'll see that inside the vacuum the virtual electron positron pairs will tend to clump like ordinary matter into little globules, which is like what we see. You know, if you look at our galaxy, there's a big what's called a galactic halo. There's like an invisible sphere of this dark matter. Nobody knows what it is. There's a big invisible sphere, this stuff, and it's capturing the stars. The reason our solar system doesn't fly out into a straight line in space is because there's this big black blob, you know, in the center of things that's holding us in. And they don't know what this blob is. They think it's particles. You know, and they're looking in the Large Hadron Collider in CERN that's going online now. They're hoping to find a dark matter particle. Well, I say they're not going to find any such dark matter particle. Looking for a dark matter particle is like when Michelson and Morley, over 100 years ago, they looked for the motion of the Earth through the ether. They found there was no motion of the Earth through the ether, and that's what Einstein, that's how he, you know, that's connected with his discovery of E equals mc² and special relativity in 1905. So what I'm saying is that they have the wrong idea, because they're looking for dark matter as a real particle. And in quantum field theory, we distinguish between real particles outside the vacuum and virtual particles inside the vacuum. So I'm saying that both the dark energy and the dark matter, which is most of the gravitating stuff in our universe, it can be easily understood as zero-point vacuum fluctuations of various types.
So hey, Jack, bringing it back, though, to, you know, I can tell you're really excited about this, and it is an exciting thing to figure out the nature of reality. But for people listening to this, I mean, it sure sounds like you're saying that we are all generated by computers, that that in fact it is scripted, that there is no free will.
Well, wait a minute. May not be scripted.
It can almost make it to the point where what's the point?
Well,
what's the point of us even living?
Not sure that there isn't free will, because look, you have Microsoft, you know, like the big Bill Gates in the sky, who says he's omnipotent and omniscient? I've been having my medicinals here, George, but having my Glenfiddich medicinals. So, you know, while those long commercial breaks, I started talking to the commercial. But the thing is, no, there are glitches in the this programming. And also, you know, there was this idea that on the, you know, George Norrie was writing about parallel universes. Well, you know, yeah, there may be parallel universes. In fact, that's a very standard idea. Almost all the physicists today who work in cosmology, they will say they think there are parallel universes. But the thing is, you have to distinguish between the different levels of universe. There are parallel material universes, which is the what's called the chaotic inflation theory. And that's where the wormholes happen and all the stargates and all that kind of stuff. Those are the material parallel universes. But there are also parallel quantum mental universes, you know. And that's where our mind, there's a mind field. In fact, the way to think about quantum theory through this kind of Bohmian interpretation is that what there are two levels of reality. There is this quantum reality, which is a kind of a mental wave field, and then there's the material level, and what happens is that it's the interaction of the quantum mental waves or the quantum thought waves with the material field configurations that's the way the world works, and all the quantum weirdness is kind of the interaction of the mental quantum field with the material field. And so the thing is that once you have that picture, it's pretty easy to understand what consciousness is.
I remember reading this book by a guy named David Deutsch from Oxford, The Fabric of Reality, in which he laid out the case for the multiverse, and he talked about quantum computers. And boy, once you read that and get your head around it, you never look at the world the same way. But it's sort of exciting to the idea that there could be an unlimited numbers of Jack Sarfatti's and George Knapps out there in other realities.
Well, Max Tegmark, another. There are a couple of these young physicists today who were doing like far out good stuff, and Sean Carroll is one of them. Max Tegmark, over at MIT, and there's this guy Matt Visser, who's kind of a mountain man in New Zealand. He writes about stargates and all that kind of stuff, and that's what these guys think. They really think that.
But, is one reality more real than the rest of them?
Probably not. Well, it depends what you mean. I think, what did Bill Clinton say? Depends what you mean by is.
What is is. I'm not sure I know what I mean, but if there are unlimited numbers of jacks out there, is there one central jack?
Yeah, there's what's called the Feynman histories approach to quantum physics, and in that there's what's called the classical limit, in which you have all these competing parallel worlds, but there's certain configurations of them where they constructively interfere, and that creates our kind of classical reality. So, in a certain sense, the classical reality may be more real than some of these quantum realities, but the point is, in the parallel universe theory, there are many different classical realities, so to speak. It gets pretty tricky. But, before we get into the details of physics, I do want to go back and explain what we're trying to do with stardrive.org.
Sure. Sure.
Okay, because think of, this Ford Motor Company and General Motors. Okay, Ford Motor Company back years ago, they're making the Model T, they're making the Taurus, they're making the, mass-produced cars for everybody. But what do? They also buy Aston Martin and Jaguar, okay, because it's different markets, it's different niches, okay? Now, you look at Facebook and MySpace and all these, I forget, there are probably others, and Twitter for half-twits. Sorry, I shouldn't say that, but, be on Twitter myself. I never can figure. I'm too old for Twitter. I can't figure out Twitter. It's too small. A little thing. It's too compressed for me, for my complex mind. My super mind from outer space. But the thing is that there are people who are into science. They're really into science and science fiction and the paranormal and weird stuff. And they want a little bit more. They want to use the power of the social networking. But if you're on Facebook, you can't write more than a few bits. Otherwise, you're cut off. So you can't have serious discussion. So in our StarDrive site, this is for people who have serious things they want to discuss. And they can discuss it, as much as they can. They can talk to each other. They don't even have to talk to us. I mean, it's exact like Facebook. You can go off. They can create their own communities. So that's why I encourage everyone listening to check out our site and see if you want to use it. Also, we have kids.
I think a lot of listeners are trying to log on but can't get on, though.
Oh, yeah. Well,
are you overloaded?
Okay, now we were under cyber attack earlier tonight, okay? And right now, I urge your listeners to have patience and wait a few days. We have to get a dedicated server. Right now, we're kind of on a party line. We're on the host rocket, and we just have this thing up for a week, so there's a lot of bugs yet. But bear with it. Maybe you'll have me back on again when things are more mature, whatever. But, yes, they're going to – I expect the site will crash, but that's good. That means a lot of interest in it. Okay, and we'll get everything working in due course.
So I want to jump into this, but Jack, before we get too far afield. Yeah. You had mentioned you think that this is a computer that's generating this hologram from the future, and it sort of goes back to something you talked about the first time you were here, and that is an experience you had as a youngster where you got a call from a computer-generated voice. Does that sort of fit into your theory now?
It fits in totally, which is why my mind is being blown all the time.
Well, explain that. Explain the specifics of that to the listeners.
This is my book. I have a book, Destiny Matrix, where it's on Amazon. Anybody can get it. The detailed story is there. You can find it on the web. A lot of people have written about it. Robert Anton Wilson has written about it. Of course, he's dead now. But what happened was, when I was a kid, 13 years old, I was a very bright kid, as you can imagine, and also, I must mention, my grandfather worked for the Army, so at the Army Quartermaster Corps, so even before that, when I was 9, 10, 11, I used to hang out at this Army headquarters in the Garment District in New York, where they had all these experiments going on, and I used to ride around in Army cars with these colonels, and I think Colonel Corso was one of those guys. When I saw Colonel Corso's pictures, hey, I know that guy. He was sitting in the back of the car with my grandfather's driving the Army car. But in any case, I was always into rockets and stuff, and obviously these guys were studying me, and a bunch of maybe other kids too. So I was known to the Army back in the late 40s. We're talking like Roswell was, what, 1947? And I'm sorry, right. Maybe 1949, 1950, whenever Captain Video, in fact, the Captain Video studio is right down the block. I used to sneak in and watch them shooting Captain Video. Most of you guys, they're too young to even know what Captain Video was, but it was like the first kind of, Star Trek thing. But in any case, so I was alone one day in my house. I'm about 13 years old, and the phone rings. And I was reading this book on the ENIAC computer, which I got from the Brooklyn Library on Prospect Avenue on switching circuits. And the phone rings, and I hear, clunk, clunk, clunk. And I hear Stephen Hawking. This is 1952, 1953. I hear Stephen, you know what Stephen Hawking sounds like with his computer voice?
Right.
Okay. This was Stephen Hawking, that kind of voice, but it's 1953. Okay? So Stephen Hawking calls me and says, Jack, it says it's a computer from the future on board a flying saucer. And that they've identified me as one of several hundred, I think they said 400 bright young minds that they want to teach their stuff to. I mean, I'm summarizing, but that's basically what the thing said. And I'm a Brooklyn kid in Flatbush, right by Brooklyn College in Flatbush, and I know about, perps and perverts even back then. I was a streetwise smart kid. I had my own gang. I was a gang leader.
But this was not a pervert. This was a computer, you think?
Well, but I thought at first it was and then I didn't know, and I realized, and so I was interested, but I was also pretty scared because what it said was, look, it said I had to give them free will choice. Okay, I had to decide by whether I was going to do it or not. And when they said that, and then they said, I was getting very scared, but also fascinated. I remember it was like a kundalini. I didn't know what it was then. It was like an electric shock went from the base of my spine to the back of my neck. And I was thinking no, and I said yes. Okay. And then what happened? It said, okay, well, go to your, fire escape, go to your window, and we'll send the ship and we'll pick you up in 10 minutes. Now, as soon as they said that, then I got scared. I said, what the hell, what is it? They know I got a fire escape. This is Flatbush in Brooklyn. And I got scared, and it was a summer night, and I ran downstairs. I ran like a bat out of hell, and I got my gang. I have like gang Norman and Winky, who became a cop, a homicide detective, Al Bro, his name was. And I got, three of my gang, and I said, hey, but contact my flying saucer. And we went upstairs, and we waited. Of course, nothing ever happened. Okay, but what they also said during this phone conversation, they said you'll begin to meet the others in the future. Now that was,
and you think that's happened? You think that has happened?
It's 20 years. You'll meet the others 20 years in the future. Okay, so who do I meet in the future? Who do I meet in the future? I'm at Stanford Research Institute in the future, 1973. I'm a professor of physics at San Diego State University. I'm called, to a very strange set of circumstances I don't have time to go into. I'm called at who? I'm there with Hal Puthoff. I'm there with Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut. I'm there with Russell Targ, a bunch of other people. And, with these CIA experiments on Uri Geller and Pat Price and all this stuff, and I'm on my way to Europe, and I'm also in Europe. I'm with Fritjof Copper, who's writing down physics. I mean, all kinds of adventures happen when I go behind the Iron Curtain, the Soviet Union. They're involved. I mean, there's all this kind of stuff. And I meet Geller and this guy Ira Einhorn, who's kind of notorious.
Looking at it from this vantage point, you getting a call from something that sounds like a computer generated. Yeah. Voice on a flying saucer telling you about your future, and now your theory being that the computers in the future are generating everything we see around us.
And it's not just my theory. I mean, it's like, it's in the air. It's not just me. It's a network of people. It's a network of the greatest minds on the planet. Some of them are like sleepwalking. Robert Kessler wrote this book called The Sleepwalkers, how scientists, they kind of like drift into it. They don't even know what they're doing half the time. They really don't. Yeah, but scientists, okay, let me tell you something. Most physicists, especially smart theoretical physicists, they are autistic. They have, what is that syndrome? There's that, it's kind of autism. It's something, a Jacob something syndrome. I mean, I have it a little bit, too. I mean,
Jacob Creutzfeldt disease?
No, it's not a disease. It's something else.
It's sort of like Rain Man?
A little bit. Not as bad as Rain Man. Well, some of them are. Some of them are. Not all of them. But, there's something, I forget what it's called. There's some kind of syndrome. It's not quite autism. It's the semi, you have to, even Einstein had it. Einstein was autistic as a kid. He didn't talk until he was like 3 or 4 years old. So it goes with, a certain kind of a powerful intellect. It's focused in. In order to do theoretical physics, When you look at some of these papers that these guys write, you know, I mean, it's even hard for me to understand. It's hard for other physicists to understand them. But in any case, wait, before we leave what happened, I just want to say something that it's not just my fantasy, what happened, you know, in 53, because my mother finally spoke, to the computer. And this is what's really weird, because what happened was back in 73, 74, so I'm with Andrea Puharich. It's 1974, and Andrea Puharich is writing this book about Uri Geller.
I'm afraid we're going to not get to the end of that story, Jack. We're going to take a break here. When we come back, I'll let you finish that story. And I want to get into the physics of the paranormal, how to build a UFO, whether you think that maybe we have the technology here already. Stay with us. Our guest, Dr. Jack Sarfatti on Coast to Coast AM. Hour two of our conversation with Dr. Jack Sarfatti, the rogue physicist, I guess, maverick physicist might be a better word for it, author of a book called Super Cosmos and others, and creator of something called stardrive.org, here to talk with us tonight about the physics of the paranormal. Jack, we could go on and on about the multiverse, but I want to jump into the UFO topic. You know, you travel in really interesting circles, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program. You know a lot of guys who work in the black world or did work in the black world. You talk to them on and off the record. I'd like to hear you tell me regarding UFO technology. You know, we hear a lot of stories about recovered technology, back-engineered technology. I'd like to hear your theory. Do we have it? And as a corollary to that, do we even need it? I mean, could we build this stuff ourselves?
Well, you know, I've never seen it, okay? I've never seen it. I do have people who are inside the intelligence community who, at least one person who said he knows about it. So I don't know, but I do, you know, my interest is whether or not we have it, can we build it? Okay.
And the answer to that?
Well, I think, you know, I can't build it for you today, and I certainly can't build it sitting in, you know, in Telegraph Hill in San Francisco, you know. I mean, if I had a couple of billion dollars, $100 billion, and a couple of thousand physicists and engineers, maybe we could come up with something in 5 to 10 years. I don't know. But I certainly think it's something we should aspire to building. You know what I mean? It's a noble, just like, you know, when Kennedy said we're going to put somebody on the moon, I mean, you know, if there's a will, there's a way. There's definitely, let's put it this way, since the discovery of dark energy, which is an anti-gravitational field, okay, it's obvious that these things are possible. Now let me, you know, when I was at Cornell back in the late 50s, I try to think how long ago that was, I was in the Air Force ROTC, okay, and one of the things we had to do was to do bombing, you know, like plan we're bombing this and bombing that, but playing war games, okay? And as a scientist, you know, we're like lawyers. You know, a lawyer can take, he could be either be for the defense, for the prosecution, okay? The whole idea of a top theoretical physicist is like an attorney. He can take any, he can view all the possibilities. You know, a scientist should never believe anything. I don't believe anything because, you know, I'm scientist pragmatic. We could be wrong. The whole idea, if it's good science, it's not religion. You know, it's not a true belief. It's not like Al Qaeda, jihad. You know, we're going to, you know, kill for Allah. It's not that kind of thing at all. Everybody, you know, we have to be open-minded, but we have to have critical skepticism, but be open-minded and view all the possibilities. So that's the game I'm playing. I'm still playing those war games from Cornell, you know, in the 50s with the Air Force ROTC. On the one scenario, one game is that everything, all the data that's like, you know, Bigelow's National Institute of Discovery Science and even the book he wrote, Skinwalker, all that stuff, let's assume all that data is true. I'm not going to waste my time arguing with a bunch of skeptics like James Randi, and I got to be careful what I say, whether or not the data is true. Let's just suppose it's true. And that's what I've been talking. If a certain data set is real, accept that as a just for the sake of argument, and how can the laws of science or know it possibly explain it? Okay? So I don't know whether that UFO data is real or not real, because it wasn't there. It's a complicated thing, and maybe it's a big disinformation operation by, you know, like what Gordon Novell said, the Majestic 12 is doing this and that. Who the hell knows? Maybe he's right. But suppose the data is true. Then what does it mean? And all I know is from my own experience when I was a kid with the computer, I said it was on board a spacecraft. Now, that could have been the Army intelligence, you know, stimulating me to study science. That's quite possible. But then it's still pretty weird that 20 years later things start happening, which don't happen to ordinary people. And it keeps, you understand, if you look at the pattern, even if it was the Army, it's like X-Files. It's exactly like Twilight Zone X-Files, like Mulder and X-Files. All these weird things happen. And we don't
think we could build a UFO, travel through a stargate or a wormhole, if we had the money and the time to do it, but there's no scientific reason we couldn't.
There's no scientific reason at this point, not since the discovery of dark energy, that we couldn't do it. Now, let me preface this. What I'm saying is conditional, because what my whole thing here, I look at the data. I mean, scientists, physicists, basically experiment is the final arbiter. So I'm saying, if the UFO data, as reported by Bigelow's people, okay, and were put off and all these guys, Kit Green, everybody who's on, Jacques Vallée, all these guys, and Eric Davis, these guys, all those guys, and if what you report in your book, Skinwalk with Combs, if all that's true, and if what Bruce McAbee says is true, and what Stanton Friedman says is true, these are all, serious people. And if you throw out all the nonsense, there are a lot of crazy people, saying all kinds of nutty things, you throw that, there's still this solid stuff. I mean, Bigelow's a smart man. He doesn't hire, ex-CIA and special forces people, and FBI agents. These guys are serious people. And if they vet the data, they say, these black triangles in the sky are there. Okay, well, that's data. That's a data point. That's the same as when WMAP on the NASA space probe comes out with this, with the data points. And the theorists get to work, well, here's the data. How do we make sense of it? So I take the UFO data, the good data. I say, how do we make sense of it? Well, what that data shows is that somebody out there knows how to do it already. All we have to do is catch up. And that's, by the way, that's what Edgar Mitchell says. He was on the moon, right? That's what the astronaut, who friend of George Bush Sr., right? That's what Mitchell says. They're only 100 years ahead. And that's what seems to be. Now, 10 years ago, we had this guy, Joe Firmage. He had made a lot of money, and he funded us. He gave us a couple of $1 million, and we explored certain things down at various defense contractors. But that was before the dark energy. The dark energy discovery was first coming out in 1999. We were, we got a couple of $1 million from Joe, this group, under Creon Levitt from NASA, and a bunch of Russian physicists, French physicists, and we were researching this kind of stuff. But we didn't have, if I would have understood back in 10 years ago what this dark energy really meant, I didn't understand it until 2002. And I write, you'll see my books, And that's only dawned on me. Well, that's what we were missing. That's the missing link from observation, from experiment. And that you couple the discovery of dark energy with the data of Bigelow's group and McAbee, all the Stanton Friedman, and you take that together and it all fits. Plus, what happened to me as a kid, right?
And it all sort of points the way that this is a doable thing, that it's not beyond our abilities. We need to take a break.
Yes, exactly.
We need to take a short break. Hold on, Jack. Right. Hold on a second. We'll take this break and get it out of the way and come back and talk about the nature of the propulsion system, what might be used to get us to the stars. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Jack Sarfati is my guest here on Coast to Coast AM. Jack, based on our conversation there in the last segment, am I guessing correctly to say that you would have no trouble accepting the idea that people from somewhere else are visiting here?
Absolutely. Of course. But they have to come through stargates. Now, there are various problems. There's some Stephen Hawking has what's called the chronology protection conjecture, which he argues that time travel to the past is not possible. All right? And I think there are, it's controversial. And let's put it this way. If the UFO data is correct, then Stephen Hawking is wrong about that. And, even Kip Thorne, they have a bet, nobody really knows, okay? Now, there's another thing for warp drive. In order for there to be warp drive, it turns out the current models we have of warp drive by this guy Alcubierre, it's a toy model, there is this horizon, like the cosmic computer. It's like a cosmic computer on a smaller scale. It's like the warp bubble. And the warp bubble is a wall of light, and you can't punch through the wall of light. So even if you can do it, you couldn't navigate the thing because you couldn't see what was coming ahead of you. You couldn't control the warp bubble. So that's an issue. But I think there are ways out of that, too. So there are all kinds of, what look like to be serious objections, but I think none of them are fatal. And why do I think none of them are fatal? Well, I have some theoretical reasons why I think none of them are fatal. But because if the data of UFOs is correct, then we know that someone has solved these problems. And by the way, the best book on UFO propulsion It was an old book in terms of like a Sherlock Holmes, you know, purely deductive from the data, very empirical. Was this engineer named Paul Hill, and he wrote, I guess, Unidentified Flying Objects or something. It's an old book from many years ago, and he deduced, just from the observations from that, he deduced the kind of the Alcubierre warp drive idea. I think he called it acceleration field. You know, he didn't know general relativity. He was just a really good engineer, like a Sherlock Holmes of engineers. And so that is a really solid book to go back on, okay? And so, you know, I think it's, you know, given that the UFO data is real, then clearly we can do this. Where there's a will, there's a way. It's just that people lack vision. You know, people don't have guts. And, you know, that people are stupid. Look, you know, it's a matter of intelligence. Look what happened with Iraq. Right? Look what happens when the intelligence community fails. You know, we thought there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and there weren't any. And look what's happened. I mean, it's a big disaster.
Well,
there's also
a lack of will. For example, people in your line of work, they don't want to hear the UFO data.
They close their ears.
They don't want to hear it.
They got no cojones, George. They got no cojones. They're all afraid of their, you know, of getting fired. There's no money. I mean, they're all into their retirement and this and that. You know, they're afraid. They're sheep. They're sheep. And it's groupthink. It's the same groupthink that led to us going into Iraq when we didn't have to. We should stay in Afghanistan. You know, I mean, it's, we're doing stupid things. Look at the financial system. Look at the collapse of the financial system. You know, look at the Tea Party movement, all that stuff. I mean, why? By the way, you know who helped with the collapse of the financial system? Were the string theorists, the physicists. They did the financial derivatives. People were warning about that, and were like a bunch of idiots, me, myself included, a bunch of schmucks. Pardon me. I don't know if they have to. Yeah, you know, that's Yiddish. That's okay.
You know, I think that's acceptable. Go ahead.
Is it or not?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, okay. Well, we're all a bunch of schlemiels. Okay, schlemiel, that's exactly. But, I mean, we're all a bunch of schlemiels. We go off and we, you know, we let these idiots, they don't know what they're doing. And it's the same in science. I mean, we're just humans, so I guess it's the human condition. You know.
It's a similar story for ESP, remote viewing. You know a lot of the guys in that program, and scientists don't want to hear it, you know?
They don't want to hear it. And by the way, there's a very good physicist now, though he may not want to admit what the implication of his own work. There's a guy named Anthony Valentini. There are a couple of these young guys, you know, as I said, it's Valentini, it's Matt Visser, it's Maxi Tegmark at MIT, it's Sean Carroll at Caltech. Yeah, a couple of these guys who, in spite of themselves, because they're very smart kids, and they're getting to the weird stuff, you know, they've been influenced by John Wheeler, who was, you know, was like a real, he was the Merlin, the real visionary shaman of physics, okay. And, these guys are coming to these weird ideas. But, okay, so Tony Valentini, he took Bohm's theory. He showed exactly how you have to change quantum physics by a little bit in order to account for all the weird paranormal remote viewing, and it's called signal non-locality. And if you go on stardrive.org and you communicate to the people who want to learn more, just contact me through the stardrive.org website, and there will be discussions about all these things in detail. Okay.
Can you explain it, though, in layman's terms, what it means?
Yeah, okay. Well, what happens in ordinary quantum theory, there's what's called entanglement. There's this Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen entanglement that's being used in quantum computers, quantum teleportation. It's called entanglement. But it's like God is malicious. Einstein said that God was subtle but not malicious. Well, you know, most quantum physicists really think that God is malicious, because it says even though there is this non-local, spooky, telepathic action at a distance, the way Einstein once described it back in 1935 or so, even though it's out there, you can't use it. It's like God is an evil guy. It's like we're kids. God gives us a toy. Says, here's this beautiful toy, but you can't play with it. What kind of a God is that?
Mischievous.
So now it turns out that David Bohm and really Basil Hiley at Birkbeck College, they really kind of understood this. And there's a book called The Undivided Universe that was written, finished by Basil after Bohm died in 93. And they have the key idea in there. And then Valentini went on with it. And also Brian Josephson from Cambridge, a Nobel Prize physicist, he saw this thing coming too. But Valentini really has made it now mathematically precise. And just like this, look, In 1905, Einstein came out with the special theory of relativity. It led to the atomic bomb. 10 years later, he comes out with the general theory of relativity, which is a theory of the gravitational field, and it turns out whenever you have a bigger theory, general relativity is a bigger theory than special relativity. And things that are not possible in special relativity are possible in general relativity. Well, it's the same thing for quantum mechanics. The kind of quantum mechanics that the physicists are brainwashed in school, and which works pretty well for particle beams. It works for the LHC at CERN, the $6-7 billion machine. It works fine for certain kinds of experiments, but it's a special limiting case of a more general theory. And that more general theory, guess what? It has. It has remote viewing in it. It has remote viewing. Everything gets simple. I mean, everything is clear. It's, it's basically pretty simple. Even every, dumb Joe in the street can understand it if it's properly explained. But, it's tricky, to get it properly explained. I'm trying to do it a little bit, but, the limitations of an hour and a half, I would have to like give lectures on radio and people watching their computer screens. I point to this, the computer laptop is like an electronic blackboard
But it's sort of like the example you use with UFOs. We know if the data is true that somebody has mastered this.
Yes.
We know from data acquired by people, Hal Puthoff and folks like that, people do have these abilities.
Hey, listen, I'm not going to mention his name. I have a lawyer here in North Beach, okay? He's very psychic. He's very psychic. For 2 weeks before 9/11, he was waking up with dreams of airplanes hitting skyscrapers. Okay? And he's not a flaky, you meet him in the street, he's very, he's a lawyer. I mean, he's just a nice Jewish guy from New York, and he's having dreams about, and he's not a liar. He wouldn't lie about this. And they're witnesses. I mean, the witnesses before it happened, he was talking about it in North Beach. It's well known, okay? That's one good example of precognitive remote viewing that Russell Targ talks about. Well, of course it's real. Of course it's real, it's like the Vatican people with Galileo. They wouldn't look through the damn telescope. Bunch of schlemiels, because they're worried about being respectable, being conservative, getting their grants. And it's the same thing with the guys running the government and the financial system. It all collapsed, and we're all a bunch of schlemiels. And so, you're out of a job. You have 11% unemployment. What do you think? If you're not going to learn what the truth is, you're not going to try to think about these things, then you're going to get screwed. Yeah, I'm sorry, you'll have to.
No, that's okay. You're a believer that time travel is possible. You touched briefly on it earlier, and I know in your book, Super Cosmos, you touch on why the suggested time travel paradoxes may not be true. And a lot of people raise this objection that you can't go travel back in time, you can't kill your grandfather, that whole scenario.
Put that in
a nutshell, why it is possible.
By the way, it's not just me who says that. There's a lot of every good physicist. You ask even Eric Davis, all these guys. They'll tell you the same thing. And there are two ways at it. There's Igor Novikov, who works with Kip Thorne. Novikov is a guy from Moscow. He wrote a very good book called, I think, The River of Time. And he explains why all these objections about time travel are just nonsense. I mean, there's what's called the globally self-consistent loop in time, and also the many worlds also saw. There are two. David Deutsch talks about time travel, and he does it in terms, he explains the paradoxes are not paradoxes because of the many worlds theory. But even if there's only one world, then Novikov can explain. So either way, that's not the case. And also, there's this famous thing about if you have time travel to the past, then, ideas, things create themselves. Well, that's exactly what our universe is. There's this famous Heinlein story about, a physicist gets a book about how to make a time machine in the past, and he travels into the future, and the book kind of writes itself. That's not a paradox. That's a self-consistent loop in time. That's actually good physics.
Didn't Philip K. Dick have an experience, something like that, something like what happened to you?
Exactly. Oh, yeah. And by the way, we have people in common. Dick and I were connected like we're one person apart. People I know knew Dick and all that kind of stuff. So that's not, in fact, the future computer hologram horizon, our future cosmic horizon, which is connected to dark energy, that's what Dick called VALIS, vast active living intelligence. That's also what Sir Fred Hoyle called the black cloud. It's what Olaf Stapleton, these are science fiction things, called the star maker. You read John Lilly of The Scientist, very good book about this kind of stuff. And this stuff is in the air. The poets, the visionary, the artists saw it before the scientists, and now scientists, you know, it turns out science is the physics of the precision cosmology. Cosmology is consistent with a holographic universe created from the future, backwards in time, like back from the future. Yeah. So wow. All these ideas are there. Now, did you want to take calls or anything?
We are going to take calls. We're going to go into a break here coming up in a couple of seconds, and we'll take some calls and see what's on the minds of our audience out there. We're talking with Dr. Jack Sarfatti about physics of the paranormal. We can talk about UFO propulsion, time travel, you name it. We're going to be taking a break. Are we coming up on that? Here it comes. Yeah, Jack, stay with us. We'll be back with more Coast to Coast AM. We are going to the phones with your questions for Dr. Jack Sarfatti, east of the Rockies, Cody in Cleveland. Hi, Cody.
Hi. I had a proposed solution to both the nature of the holographic universe and the dark matter, dark energy problem.
Okay. Is that something that can be done in a couple of minutes? Because we got a lot of people on the phone lines. That sounds like maybe that's going to take some time.
Yeah, I think, no. You know what? I think that stuff, rather than getting these, because that will waste time. But I encourage you to join stardrive.org when the server's up. I don't know if it's up or not, you know, next few days, and discuss it there, because there'll be a forum, social networking, where we can do that in depth. But I don't think there's enough time next few minutes to get into that.
Cody, I appreciate the call, but it sounds like a little too much to bite off in just a phone call. So we invite you to go to that stardrive.org and converse there with Jack and his colleagues.
I look forward to hearing from you, Cody.
Thanks. West of the Rockies, Palm Springs, California. How you doing?
Hello. Yes, I have a question about the concept of people from the future or something communicating with us. The author Barbara Marciniak, in her book Bringers of the Dawn, talks about the Pleiadians, and she discusses the same concept. So I was just wondering what... you have to say about that, if you can say more about it.
Sweetheart, I don't know much about it. I'm generally aware of that, and possibly, I just don't know, so I don't want to say yes or no about it, because it's not, but it's certainly consistent with the worldview I'm talking about. Again, we're living in a kind of virtual Matrix reality, like the movie Matrix or Matrix Reloaded or that movie The 13th Floor, and definitely, if my physics ideas are right, if Anthony Valentini's right about signal non-locality and stargates, you know, exist, they could be coming from all kinds of places, not just the Pleiades, whatever it is. But yeah, so I would say let's go on to the next caller, I think. But that's please join stardrive.org, and there'll be plenty of people you can discuss that with there.
Okay, first time caller Tom in Florida. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how you doing? I got a little cold, so bear with me, and I'll talk fast.
You should listen, I'm a doctor. I'm telling you what, you take some medicinal, you take some good scotch, single malt scotch, and you'll feel better.
I love scotch, Chivas Regal. I'm a metaphysics person, and I use physics, and I had an experience like you did, but on a metaphysical level where things started coming true, and I had a vision, and I wrote it down, and it's coming out. I'm publishing in a book any day now. And what's interesting, what you're saying is phenomenal, because I kept thinking the physical world was a sort of the physical world almost was not actually real in a sense, and that we started our creation story maybe on Earth and walked away from paradise out as far as we can go. We may have went out into space. The Big Bang could be where we turned around because we self-destruct, and now we're heading back again, doing the story over again.
All right, listen, again, let's not spend too much time because time is very limited, but do join stardrive.org and post to your heart's content there, and there'll be plenty of people who will respond to this, okay? That's the forum for these ideas, but I look forward to hearing from you.
Tom, were you going somewhere with that one?
Pardon?
Are you still there?
Yeah.
Were you going somewhere soon with that one?
With what I was just saying?
Yeah.
Well, I was saying that we're going back again, and now we're going to go back to the threshold, but this time, because of the Jesus factor, we're going to finish our story, but in a spiritual manifestation, not in an outer space manifestation. We already came from there.
Well, that's an interesting idea, and I don't think Jack has a way to answer it, do you, Jack?
No, but he's welcome to discuss it. There'll be plenty of people who are into his kind of trip, and they can all social network with each other on Star Drive. Nothing against it.
All right, Tom, thanks for the call. Thanks for the call, Tom. Wildcard line, Bill in Connecticut. Hi, Bill.
Yes. Hi, George. Hi, Doctor. Hi. This is Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut. I'm an amateur astronomer, and I know space science and astronomy and cosmology. And I want to talk about a couple of missions, unmanned cosmology and astrophysics missions that are in space now.
Yes.
One that's going to be launched later this year or early next year to the International Space Station. And I want to ask you if these missions, and I'll name them very briefly, if they could add hard data, good hard data, to give us a big run-up, catch-up up to maybe to the level of what you're saying could indeed be true. I'm thinking of missions like you mentioned WMAP. I'm thinking of Planck, the European Space Agency, Planck, for example, as well as GLASS, Gamma Ray Large Area Space Telescope, also known as the Fermi Space Telescope, as well as the one going to the International Space Station late this year called AIMS, AMS Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. Could you discuss these missions and if they will maybe give us evidence on the multiverse after all and other dimensions as well?
Listen, all these are good projects. I fully support them, and it's important they be done. And anything, all the data we're getting from space now will either confirm or deny some of the things that I'm saying. So the answer is let's wait and see, and it's a good thing we're at least doing that. So
Before the budget cuts, the next round set in.
Yeah.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for the call. Wildcard John in Seattle. Hi, John.
Hey. Doctor and George, thanks a lot for taking my call. Listen, I got to drop the bomb here about what I think is about a top-secret government jet propulsion test lab, okay? I lived in Hawaii for the last 12 years on the island of Maui, okay?
Oh, yeah?
One of the islands that nobody's allowed to go on, basically the island, is called Kaho'olawe. Okay, the government's reasoning that no one can go on this island is that they dropped too many bombs on it during World War II and used it as a practice run. Okay, well, none of the locals believe this, and they all dispute it. They argue that 10 times as many bombs, at least, were dropped on Oahu by the Japanese, and today there's almost 1 million people living on that island. Okay, so it's been 50 years since anybody from the
Wait, are you saying atomic bombs or conventional bombs?
Conventional.
Just conventional, right? And they've had a cleanup project going on over there for the last 40 years, right? Yeah. Okay, so here's the thing. I've sat out on the beach many times at night. Okay, this island's only about four miles across the channel from the southern shore of Maui, where I lived, okay? And I've seen fly off of this island, okay, me with many other friends, many witnesses, okay, what appears to be a helicopter when it takes off, okay? And when it takes off, what it does is it goes out and it flies over the channel in between Lanai, Kaho'olawe, and Maui. Then something comes up from the ocean, what appears to be the periscope of a submarine.
Yes.
Okay. And I've looked at this thing through some pretty high-power binoculars.
Wow.
Then the thing starts blinking different colors, red, white, and blue, believe it or not, okay? Then it starts moving around and bouncing around like it's on some kind of magnetic connection to the thing that popped up out of the ocean, okay?
Yeah.
When I start looking at this thing, okay, it's in the northern horizon, I would say at about 20 or 30 degrees above the horizon.
Yeah.
By the end of the night, okay, even an hour and a half or 2 hours later, by the time I'm done watching it, this thing is up in the sky, up what appears to be up in the cosmos with the stars, and it's shooting around at no less than Mach 1 or Mach 2, okay?
Okay, have you been able to video it? Have you been taking any pictures?
I took a video into CNN. I went to the local news station there, the local public access programming, which is called Akaku, Channel 54.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
didn't want to hear it. I tried to get them to send their own cameraman out there to film it. They didn't want to hear it. I sent it into CNN. I never heard back.
Okay,
from
listen,
CNN.
Tell me, what's your name again? What's your name first?
My name is John. I'm
John,
from Seattle.
John, listen, I have a couple of friends who actually live on Maui, but also this is something that Bill Burns from UFO Hunters would definitely want to investigate. But listen, I urge you, you know, when you can, as soon as our server, you know, so just keep trying, join stardrive.org. Now, Kimber Afato, who's handling the UFO stuff, he is an ex-Navy combat photographer, and he's also a qualified investigator for MUFON, okay? And so he will handle all this kind of, your story is extremely interesting, very interested in it, and I look forward to you contributing, you know, what you have seen to Star Drive on the appropriate forum, and this bears investigation. Bill Burns should go out there like right away. I don't know what, you know. So So, this has to be investigated.
And, yeah, it sounds interesting, John. The problem with the video from a long distance away is even something that looks spectacular to the human eye, it looks like just a ball of light in a sea of inky darkness when it's on video. It's hard to, without reference points, it's hard to tell what the heck it is.
Well, I'm sure Bill Burns would just rent a boat, a power boat, and try to go out there with his crew and see what happens, see if the Navy, stops him from going. That in itself is very interesting.
Thanks for the call, John. A wild card line, Thomas in Alabama. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, George. How are you?
Okay.
All right, I got a quick question for Dr. Sparty.
Mm-hmm.
On the International Space Station, me and a friend were watching a newscast that they had, and they were speaking about engineering viruses on the International Space Station.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, maybe that's a clever ploy for some governments to engineer strange viruses, something.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I'm skeptical about any malicious intent. Of course, it's harder to be, of our government, trying to engineer viruses. But definitely, there's a biological experiments going on up there. And again, join our Star Drive. There's Creon Levitt, who's a NASA scientist at NASA Ames, who knows about all this kind of stuff. In fact, he works with the head of NASA Ames, a retired general from the U.S. Space Command. So we have access to information. If you join there and ask these questions in detail, I think you'll have some satisfaction.
Thomas, is that it? I think Thomas is gone.
Yeah.
We're going to Charisse in Illinois. Hi, Charisse.
Hi. I want to disagree about reality versus unreality, that reality might not be so real. I think it's only a matter of psychology, the people who come up with that idea, because, for example, my whole life has been mostly really awful, and the two times I thought something happy was going to happen to me felt unreal, and I'm wondering if the people who come up with the theory of things are not so real, is it because their own lives are not so awful? It seems like when your life is really terrible, reality, I've never had a sense of unreality until something happy might happen to me, and then it felt unreal. And so I think that it's just psychology going on, because if there's no reality, then there has to be a reality for there to be no reality.
Yeah, what you say is very sensible.
I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thanks for the call. That's interesting.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is very sensible, but there's more to it than that. I mean, what you're saying is true, but there's another level that you're talking about, George. But let's go on, yes.
East of the Rockies, Jonathan in Atlanta. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, George, Jack. Reality, unreality, I guess it's all semantics and perspective, right? You mentioned the term matrix. What was it? Morpheus told Neo in the movie, the matrix was the world that's been pulled over our eyes to blind us from the truth.
Maybe God is playing
that trick on us. But
what do you mean, like going into Vietnam? I mean, into Iraq to get weapons of mass deception?
Weapons of mass deception. Yeah. Reality. William Tiller, in the sequel to What the Bleep Do We Know movie, said an astonishing thing that amazed me. What kind of evidence is there for this statement that he made that within the volume of a single hydrogen atom, there's enough energy to create a whole universe and at the Planck scale? And then there's a physicist on about a week ago, Dr. Nassim, I can't remember his last name.
Yes.
He was talking on the same level that at the Planck scale, he believes there's a, and within the core of every atom in the nucleus, there's a black hole that contains this type of energy. And what kind of evidence is there for it? Is this all
that's a tricky question. You know what? There's not much. There actually is not as much evidence for it as people used to think because of the discovery of dark energy. It turns out one of the mysteries is that the amount of energy in space is a lot smaller than everybody thought. You see, up until 10 years ago, those kinds of statements were plausible. Even I made statements like that, little black holes, stuff like that. But that's what the whole mystery of this, what's called the cosmological constant problem is. And that's where the hologram theory of the universe comes in. But these are very tricky points, very subtle. So, again, please join stardrive.org and, you know, ask these questions there, and we'll, you know, get into it, okay? But, you know, with the limited time we have here, but you're asking good questions. And, by the way, I know Bill Tiller from years ago. Bill Tiller was one of the guys involved in the 20 years after, you know, SRI. I know he's part of the story, the weird Twilight Zone story I was telling before. Bill Tiller is one of those guys. He's one of the guys, you know, he's part of the others, part of the contactee group. And I also know Nassim, okay? I met him. He's, you know, he's pretty far out. He's a contactee, by the way.
And, this idea that there's enough energy in an atom to create a universe, it leads me back to the idea of quantum computing. And I remember reading in David Deutsch's book that we referenced earlier, once we master quantum computers, that you could, in fact, if you're some super being, create your own universe. Do you buy that?
Well, sure. That's what we're talking. I mean, that's consistent with what we're, by the way, there's a very good website called Formilab, Formilab, Formilab.ch. It's out of Switzerland. And the guy who does it, he reviews books called None Dare Call It Reason. And he talks about this very idea that the universe is, you know, is being computed, and that the computer glitches, which account for all kinds of things. So I would say, yes, that idea. If you join StarDrive, you know, there's a link to his site, and he talks about these very questions in a very intelligent, brilliant way.
Back to the question of about quantum computers. Wasn't there just some sort of a breakthrough at Princeton, something to deal with quantum computers? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I think it's on StarDrive, as a matter of fact. But I can't. The breakthrough is happening so fast that I can't. Especially with my medicinals, George. It's late at night. I'm on
Social
Security here. You expect me to know what's happening in Princeton and for the rest of detail.
You had told me as we were discussing having you on the program, I wanted to talk about your book, Super Cosmos. You said it's already outdated. Are things moving that fast?
Oh, yeah. In fact, things are moving so fast. There's a lot of good stuff happening in science. Not so much in theory, you know, a few good things in theory, but certainly in technology. It's just absolutely amazing. And, you know, the Internet is magnifying it. It's an exponential expansion of knowledge. As soon as a paper comes out in physical review, it's almost out of date if it's a fundamental paper. Things are happening very fast. You know, I used to know Timothy Leary, who's dead now. And Tim, back then, he talked about his program SMILE, Space Migration, Intelligence Increase, Life Extension. And the Internet has created a global mind. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts, and we're just like little, you know, little nerve cells in this big global mind. It's super intelligent. And scientific knowledge and physics, it's going faster than any one of us can fully comprehend.
And for some of us, that like me, who have pointy little heads, it's hard to keep up with.
Well, even for the physicists, it's hard to keep up with. So, you know, that's why the social networking is so important, because we're going to be creating insights on the stardrive.org that otherwise would not be created. This is an experiment in you know, in the supermind. You know?
Give me a prediction, Jack. What's the next big breakthrough, and what would it mean?
Well, the big breakthrough, of course, would be time travel. I mean, the big breakthrough would be if we actually... if ETs actually landed on the White House lawn, I think that's a big breakthrough. But
time travel is something. Go ahead.
Let me say this: the one thing which I don't think is going to happen, when the Large Hadron Collider goes online, they're looking for dark matter particles. If they find that, then my theory is wrong. Then I'm making a fundamental mistake. Okay, so that's one thing that can see. It's very important when you do a theory in physics that there's a way to falsify the theory. Because if there's no way to falsify the theory, then it's not science. It's kind of like metaphysics or kind of like pseudoscience. And, in fact, that's been a big objection against the string theorists. You know, that.
Well, when they fire up that super collider and when they get some results back, we'll have you back on to talk about it. Jack Sarfati, thanks very much for joining us. Stardrive.org is the place where you can go to get more information. And coming up, Paul Stonehill to talk about UFO cases from the USSR. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM.